just as casual conversation starters. "I just realized something," Gus said. "You're no longer invited." "Oh, I'm definitely invited," I said. "They won't turn someone with rocks away."
"Okay, in that case, I'm coming down with something. You'll have to go alone."
"Relax." I grabbed his arm. "I won't engage in rock talk. Much." He smirked and stepped in closer to me, shaking his head.
"I'm not going. Too sick."
"You'll survive." My hand was still in the crook of his arm, his skin burning hot under my fingers. When my hand tensed on him, he edged closer, shaking his head again. My back met the cold edges of the tool rack, and his eyes swept down me and back up, leaving goosebumps in their wake. I pulled him closer, and our stomachs met, heavy want gathering behind my ribs and belly button and all the places we were touching. He lightly held my hips and eased them up to his, and heat raced down me like flames on a streak of gasoline. My breath hitched. My blood felt like it was slowing, thickening in my veins, but my heart was racing as I watched his expression change, his smile seeming to singe off at the corners of his mouth, his eyes darkening with focus. If he could see into me right then, I didn't care. I even wanted him to. One time, rushed through my brain on repeat, like tumbleweeds through a desert. And then Gus slowly bent, his nose grazing down mine until his breath hit my lips, somehow parting them without so much as a touch, and my fingers burrowed into his skin as his lips caught mine roughly, so fierce and hot and slow I felt like I would melt against him before that first kiss had ended. He tasted like coffee and the tail end of a cigarette, and I couldn't get enough. My hands knotted into his hair as his tongue slipped into my mouth. He flattened me into the tool rack as his hands rose to my jaw, angling my mouth up to his as he kissed me again, even deeper, like we were desperate to plumb the depths of each other. Every kiss, every touch, was rough and warm, like him. His hands slid down my chest, and then they were under my shirt, his fingers light as falling snow against my waist, against my bra, making my skin tingle as we rocked into each other. The rack whined as he slowly pushed me back against it, and Gus laughed into my mouth, which somehow made me feel even more desperate for him. I twisted my hands into his shirt, and his mouth drifted down my throat, slow and hungry. One of his hands grasped at my waist, while the other slipped beneath the lace of my balconette, turning heavy circles on me. He was gentle at first, every movement languid and purposeful, but as I arched under his touch, his grip tightened, making me gasp. He pulled back, breathing hard.
"Did I hurt you?"
I shook my head, and Gus touched the side of my face again, gingerly turned it to kiss each of my temples. I caught the hem of his shirt and lifted it over him, chest fluttering at the sight of his lean, hard lines. As soon as I dropped his shirt on the ground, he grabbed me, his calloused palms brushing up my sides, gathering fabric as they went. He tossed my shirt aside, then studied me intensely.
"God,"
he said, voice deep, raspy. I fought a smile.
"Are you praying to me, Gus?"
His inky gaze scraped up my body to my eyes. The muscles in his jaw leapt, and I arched against him as his hands skimmed around my back to unhook my bra.
"Something like that."
He moved one of my bra straps down my arm, his eyes tracing the slow path of his fingers as they skated down the side of my breast, following the curve of it. When they skated back up, his rough palm cupped me, sending chills out through me. Again, his touch was infuriatingly light, but his gaze was so furiously dark it seemed to dig into me, and I rocked with his motion, responding to his touch. The corner of his mouth twitched as his eyes moved back to mine. He freed my other bra strap, and the fabric fell away. The intensity of his dark eyes on my chest, drinking me in and taking his time doing it, made me shift and squirm as if I could grind against it. The muscle in his jaw pulsed, and he tugged me hard against him. There would be consequences. This had to be a bad idea. He stepped in closer, pinning me to the shelf. I reached for his hips. Chapter 21. The Cookout. Gus's hands traced down the sides of my body, feeling every exposed line and curve.
"You're so beautiful, January,"
he whispered, kissing me more tenderly.
"You're so fucking beautiful, you're like the sun."
His mouth moved down my body, tasting all the places he'd touched. It wasn't enough. My fingernails dug into his back, and he jerked me away from the rack and guided me onto the freezer beside it, fumbling with the button on my shorts. I lifted myself so he could slide them down my thighs, and as he straightened, his hands crawled back up my legs, slipped under the sides of my underwear to burrow into my skin. I arched against him, and he pulled my thighs up against his hips, his mouth moving hard against mine.
"God, January,"
he said. My want throttled my voice into a breathy gasp when I tried to reply. I ground myself against him, and his touch sharpened. We stopped being gentle with each other. I couldn't slow myself down enough to be careful with him, and I didn't want him to be careful with me. I undid his pants and jerked them down. One of his hands slid between my legs and he groaned. The other dug into my hip as his mouth trailed down my stomach. His hand squeezed my thighs and I gripped the sides of the freezer as he lowered himself between my legs and tasted me. My breaths came faster as the pressure mounted in me. His fingers sank into the creases of my hips and his name slipped between my lips. He cupped my hips, my ass harder. It wasn't enough. I wanted him. I only realized I said it aloud when he said it back to me.
"I want you, January."
He straightened and yanked me to the edge of the freezer, lifting my hips against him as I tightened my thighs against the sides of his body. "Gus," I gasped, and his gaze rolled up to me, heat pulsing under my skin.
"Do you have a condom?"
It took him a minute to answer, like his brain was translating from a second language. His eyes were still dark and hungry, his hands wrapped tight around my thighs.
"Here," he said, "in your father's spare house's basement?"
"I was thinking more along the lines of in your pocket," I said, still out of breath. He laughed, a throaty rattle.
"How would you feel if I'd brought condoms with me to tell you about the potato salad?"
"Thankful," I said.
"I didn't know this was going to happen."
Gus ran a hand through his hair in distress as the other maintained its nearly painful grip on me.
"Next door. I have some."
We stared at each other for a moment, then started grabbing our clothes off the floor and pulling them on. As we ran up the stairs, Gus grabbed my ass.
"God,"
he said again.
"Thank you for this day, Lord. Also, Jack Reacher."
We didn't bother with shoes, just ran out the door and across the yard. I reached his front door first and turned back just as Gus was coming up the steps. He let out a gruff laugh at the sight of me and shook his head as he seized me by the hips and kissed me again, flattening me against the door. I threaded my fingers through his hair, forgetting where we were, forgetting everything but his hands sliding over me, dipping into my clothes, his tongue coaxing my lips apart as I touched as much of him as I could get to. A small, dissatisfied noise slipped out of me, and he reached around my hip to twist the doorknob, leading me backward into the house. We barely made it 3 feet before he pulled my shirt off and peeled off his again. In a flash, I was on his console table, his hands undoing my shorts, sifting down over my hips and thighs as he pulled them down me and let them fall to the floor. He walked in between my knees. I lifted myself against him as he dragged his hands down my breasts, catching my nipples, massaging me until everything in me pinched tight. He scooped me off the table as I wrapped my legs around him and spun to pin me against the bookcase. His hands twisted into my thighs, and I arched against the bookcase to work my hips against his. Not enough, not even close. He undid his pants and pulled them down from right under me. My hand scraped down his front to push ineffectually at his briefs. He adjusted me against the shelf and pushed them down. It was almost too much feeling him against me. A gasp escaped me as I rolled my hips on him. He clutched me with one broad hand and groaned into my skin,
"Fuck, January."
The rumble of his voice sent goosebumps racing over me. His free hand reached along the shelf at my shoulder level until it met a blue jar in my peripheral vision. He fished a condom out of it, and I laughed despite myself. "Oh my God," I murmured against his ear. "Do you always have sex against your bookshelves? Are your books behind me right now? Is this an ego thing?" He drew back, smiling wryly as he tore the wrapper with his teeth.
"It's for on my way out the door, smartass."
His grip loosened, and he drew back a few inches.
"This is a first for me, but if it's not doing it for you, we can always wait until we stumble across a good beach cave on a rainy day."
I greedily grabbed for him, catching his bottom lip with my teeth before he could pull away any further. He closed the gap between us, kissing me hungrily as he worked the condom on. His hands came back to my waist, tender and light this time, and he coaxed me into a slow, sensual kiss as I trembled with anticipation. His first thrust was mind-meltingly slow, and everything in my body pulled taut around him as he sank deep into me. My breath caught, stars popping behind my eyes from the surprise of his size and the wave of pleasure racing through me. "Oh, God," I gasped as he rocked into me.
"Are you praying to me?"
he teased against my ear, sending a tingle down my spine. I couldn't take going this slow. I pushed against him, fast, eager, and he matched my intensity. He pulled me away from the bookshelves and spun around to sit on the couch, drawing me on top of him as he lay back. I gasped his name as he pushed into me again, his hands spanning my ribs. I leaned over him, my hands splayed against his chest as I tried to keep from coming undone. His mouth roved over my breast, and an intoxicating pulse of heat and want went through me.
"I've wanted you for so long,"
he hissed, hands tightening on my ass. A thrill rippled through my chest at the rasp of his voice.
"I have to," I admitted in a hush. "Since that night at the drive-in?"
"No,"
he said firmly.
"Before that."
My chest fluttered like there was a box fan blowing glitter around in it, and everything in me mounted, tightrope taut and quivering, as Gus went on whispering into my skin.
"Before you answered the door in that black dress with those thigh-high boots, and before I saw your hair all wet and frizzy at that book club."
Gus looped an arm around my waist and flipped us over, and I wrapped my leg around his hip, my other foot sliding down the back of his calf as he murmured against my cheek, his husky voice shimmering through me like electric current. He brushed a kiss across my jaw.
"And before that goddamn frat party."
My stomach somersaulted, and I tried to say it back, but one of Gus's hands had wound around the back of my neck and the other was trailing down my center, lancing through my thoughts like a warm knife through butter. We undulated against each other, lost ourselves in each other, everything else blurry and unnecessary around us. "Oh," I bit out as he thrust harder, deeper, and all at once I came undone. Rush after rush of pleasure rippling out through me as I clutched tight around him. He braced himself over me, burying his mouth into my neck as we unraveled together, breath hitching, muscles shivering. He collapsed beside me, breathing hard, but kept one arm draped over me, fingers curled against my ribs, and a faint, gruff laugh rose out of him as he threw his other arm over his eyes and shook his head. "What?" I asked, still catching my breath. I turned onto my side, and Gus did the same, his hand falling from in front of his face to race up the side of my thigh and hip. He leaned forward and kissed my sweat-sheened shoulder, nuzzling his face into that side of my neck now.
"I just remembered what you said about the bookshelf,"
he said in a gravelly voice.
"You can't even stop roasting me when I'm losing my mind over your body."
Warmth flooded through me, embarrassment and giddiness and something softer and harder to name. "Before that," I heard him whisper in my mind. I lay back, dropping my head onto a throw pillow. Gus's hand trailed from my hip bone to my stomach, spreading wide as he leaned over and pressed a slow kiss to it. My limbs felt exhausted and limp, but my heart was still racing. Even if I'd known something had to give between Gus and me, I never would have imagined him like this, keeping his hands on me at all times, his eyes on my mouth and body and eyes, kissing my stomach and laughing into my skin as we lay naked, wrapped together like we'd done this 100 times. What does it mean? I thought, followed by, stop trying to make everything mean something. But my chest was pulling tight as the full force of everything that had just happened settled on me. I had loved touching Gus, being touched by him like I'd known I would. But this? This was unexpected, and it was possible I loved it even more. He rested his head on my chest, his hand tracing a lazy, feather-light path back and forth in the slight valley between my hip bones. He kissed the gap between my breasts, the side of my ribs, and even in my state of near-total relaxation, a shiver went through me.
I love your body.
His voice thrummed against me. I'm a fan of yours too, I said. I prodded the scar on his lip. And your mouth. He broke into a smile and propped himself up on his elbow, hand still splayed across my belly button.
I really didn't show up to your sex dungeon to seduce you.
I sat up. How do you know I didn't seduce you? His smile crooked higher.
Because you wouldn't have had to.
His words reverberated through me again. I've wanted you for so long. No, before that. My heart leapt in my chest, then jolted again at the sudden sound of a phone ringing.
Shit.
Gus groaned and kissed my stomach one last time before rolling off the couch. He snatched his pants from the floor and pulled his phone out of his pocket. The smile melted off his face as he stared at it, lines of consternation rising between his dark brows. Gus, I said, sudden worry coursing through me. When he looked up, he seemed a little off balance. He jammed his mouth shut and jerked his gaze back to the phone.
I'm really sorry, he said. I have to take this.
Oh. I sat up, immediately aware of how thoroughly naked I was. Okay.
Shit,
he said, this time under his breath.
This will only take a few minutes. Can I meet you at your house?
I stared back at him, fighting the hurt building in my chest. So what if he was kicking me out right after sex to take a mysterious call? This was fine. It had to be. I had to be fine. He was out of my system now. That was how it was supposed to work anyway. It had never been the plan to lie naked with him while he cataloged every piece of me with slow, careful kisses. Still, my stomach was sinking as I stood and gathered my clothes. Sure, I said. Before I'd gotten my shirt on, Gus was halfway down the hall.
Hello?
I heard him say, and then a bedroom door closed, shutting me out. It was 11 when I walked back into my house. Gus and I were supposed to leave for the cookout soon. Pete had told Gus that Sonia couldn't make it until later anyway, so our best bet was to come for the first half of the day-to-night affair, pun unintended, and leave long before dessert, wine, and fireworks. When Gus had told me, I'd suggested I drive separately so he could stay until the bitter end.
Are you kidding?
He'd said.
You can't possibly imagine how much cheek-pinching you're saving me from by coming. I'm not going to be alone with that crowd for more than 30 seconds.
What if I have to use the bathroom? I'd asked. Gus had shrugged.
I'll make a getaway and leave you behind if I have to.
Aren't you like 400 years old? I'd replied. That seems a little old for both cheek-pinching and such a deep-seated fear of cheek-pinching.
I may be 400, but they've got at least 1,000 years on me and the talons of vultures.
It was strange that that conversation had only happened about 12 hours before what had happened just now. More goosebumps rose along my spine. The thought of never being with him again sent a new ache pinballing through my body, hitting every part of me he'd studied with his eyes and mouth and hands. The thought of never seeing him like that, naked and vulnerable and without any walls, whispering secrets straight into my bones, made my stomach drop. One time, that was Gus's rule, and this would definitely count. He just had an important phone call, I told myself. It's not about the rule or you or anything. But I couldn't be sure. I didn't hear from Gus again until 11:45 when he texted me, "Ready in 5?" Hardly. Even burning off energy, walking back and forth, I was still thrumming with the memory of what had happened and anxiety about what came next. I hadn't expected him to just drop it, text me like it had never happened, but probably I should have. I sighed and texted back, "Sure," then hurried into the bedroom to change into a white sundress and a pair of red sandals I'd gotten during my last Goodwill run. I threw my hair up, then took it back down before putting on as much makeup as I could in the 2 minutes I had left. Gus had cleaned up a bit. His hair was the same matted mess, but he'd put on a reasonably wrinkle-free blue button-up, the sleeves rolled up around his rigid, veined forearms. A nod was my only greeting before he climbed into the driver's seat. I got in beside him, feeling at least twice as awkward as I'd worried I would when I'd imagined some version of this scenario. "Dumb bunny, dumb bunny, dumb bunny," I chastised myself. But then I thought about the way he'd kissed my stomach, so tenderly, so sweetly. Were there really one night, one morning stands that felt that real? I looked out the window and put on my best, horribly inaccurate, 0 out of 10, carefree voice. "Everything okay?" "Mm-hmm," Gus answered. I tried to read his features. They told me enough to know I should be worried, but no more. By the time we reached Pete and Maggie's street, it was already crowded with cars. Gus parked around the corner and led the way through a side gate that opened onto one of the paths through their garden. We bypassed the front door, instead winding around the house to the backyard. A chorus of voices rose up, calling his name. When it ended, Pete sang, "January," and the rest of her guests followed suit. There were at least 20 people crowded around a couple of card tables under an ivy-draped trellis. Beer bottles and red cups littered the star-spangled paper tablecloths, and, as promised, a long table at the edge of the patio was not only crowded, but stacked with aluminum trays of food and cans of beer.
"Now there's my handsome nephew and his lovely companion."
Pete was standing at the barbecue, flipping burgers in a kiss the cook apron. She'd added in Sharpie, "JK, happily married," and Maggie was wearing her own white apron, whose message was entirely handwritten, "Kiss the geologist." Guests were crowded around a card table on the cedar-stained deck in the center of their whimsical garden, and past the edge of the deck, a few more were splashing around in the giant blue swimming pool.
"Hope you kids brought your suits,"
Pete told Gus as he bent to hug her around her spatula. She loudly kissed his cheek and pulled back.
"Water's just perfect today."
I glanced Gus's way. "Does Gus own a bathing suit?"
"Technically speaking," Maggie said, drifting forward to kiss her nephew on the cheek. "No, he does not."
She turned to plant one on me next, then went on.
"But we keep one here for him all the same. He was an absolute fish when he was little. We'd take him to the YMCA and have to set a timer to drag him out of the pool to keep him from peeing in it. We knew he'd never get out of his own volition."
"This story's completely made up," Gus said. "That never happened."
"Cross my heart," Maggie said in her wistful, airy way. "You couldn't have been more than 5. Remember that, Gussie? When you were a little guy, you and Rose would come to the pool with us once or twice a week."
Gus's face changed, something behind his eyes like he was sliding a metal door closed behind them.
"Nope, doesn't ring any bells."
Rose? Pete's real name was Posey, a little bouquet. Rose must have been her sister, Gus's mom.
"Well, the fact remains," Maggie went on. "You love to swim, whether you do it now or not, and your suit's just waiting in the spare room."
Maggie looked me up and down next.
"I'm sure we could find something that would fit you, too. It'd be long in the upward direction and the across direction. You're a tiny thing, aren't you?"
"I never thought so until this summer." Maggie rubbed my arm and smiled serenely.
"That's what living among the Dutch will do to you.
We're Hardy Stock out this-a-way. Come meet everyone. Gussie, you say hi too.
And with that, we were spirited through Pete and Maggie's back garden. Gus knew everyone, mostly faculty and the partners and children of faculty from the local university, along with two of Maggie's sisters, but seemingly had very little to say to any of them beyond a polite greeting. Darcy, Maggie's youngest sister, was a good 3 inches taller than Maggie, with yellow, straw-like hair and giant blue eyes, while Lolly was a good foot shorter than Maggie with a blunt gray bob.
She's got horrible middle child syndrome,
Maggie whispered to me as she guided me and Gus to another nook in the garden where they'd set up a beanbag toss. Two of the Labradors ran amiably back and forth, making half-assed attempts to catch the beanbags as the kids threw them.
I'm sure they'd let you join in, Maggie told us, waving toward the game.
Gus's smile split wide in that rare, unrepentant way as he turned toward her.
I think we'll just start with a drink.
She patted his arm gently.
Oh, you're Pete's godson, all right, Gussie. Let's get you two some of my world-famous blue punch.
She went on ahead, and as we followed, Gus cast a conspiratorial look my way that warned the drink would be terrible. But after our strained drive over, even that was enough to send heat down through my body, all the way to my toes.
World infamous, he whispered.
Hey, do you know what kind of stone this path is made of?
I whispered back. He shook his head in disbelief.
Just so you know, asking that question is the one thing I can never forgive you for.
We'd stopped walking on the path, in a nook formed by lush foliage, out of view of both the beanbag toss and the deck.
Gus, I said, is everything okay?
For a moment, his gaze was intense. He blinked, and the expression vanished, a careful indifference replacing it.
Yeah, it's nothing.
But there is an it, I said. Gus shook his head.
No.
There's no it except the blue punch, and there will be a lot of that. Try to pace yourself.
He started toward the deck again, leaving me to follow. When we reached it, Maggie already had two full-to-the-brim cups ready for us. I took a sip and did my best not to cough.
What's in this?
Vodka,
Maggie said airily, ticking the ingredients off on her fingers.
Coconut rum, blue curacao, tequila, pineapple juice, a splash of regular rum. Do you like it?
It's great, I said.
It smelled like an open bottle of nail polish remover.
Gussie?
She asked.
Wonderful, he answered.
Better than last year, isn't it?
Pete said, abandoning her post at the grill to join us.
At least more likely to strip the paint from a car if spilled, Gus said.
Pete guffawed and smacked his arm.
You hear that, Mags? I told you this stuff could power a jet.
Maggie smiled, unbothered by their teasing, and the light caught Gus's face just right to reveal his secret dimple and lighten his eyes to a golden amber. Those eyes cut to me, and his mild smile rose. He didn't look like a different person. He looked more at ease, more sure, like all this time I'd only ever come face to face with his shadow. Standing there in that moment, I felt like I'd stumbled on something hidden and sacred, more intimate even than what had passed between us at his house. Like Gus had pulled back the curtains in the window of a house I'd been admiring, whose insides I'd been dreaming about, but even so, underestimated. I liked seeing Gus like this, with the people he knew would always love him. We'd just had sex like the world was burning down around us, but if I ever got to kiss Gus again, I wanted it to be this version of him, the one who didn't feel so weighted down by the world around him that he had to lean just to stay upright.
Maybe that first weekend in August? Pete was saying.
She, Maggie, and Gus were all looking right at me, awaiting an answer whose question I hadn't heard.
Works for me, Gus said. January?
He still seemed relaxed, happy. I weighed my options. Agree to something without having any concept of what that something was, admit that I hadn't been listening, or fish for more information with some possibly damning questions.
What time?
I said, hoping I'd chosen the right option.
and a question that made any sense.
On weeknights, we usually do 7, but given that it's a weekend, we could do whatever time we like. Evening might still be best. This is a beach town, after all, and people might read, but they do it on their bellies in the sand.
I think this could just be so interesting, Maggie said, clapping her hands together softly. What you two do seems, externally, to be so different, but I imagine the internal mechanics are still very similar. It's like Labradorite and—
Bless you, Gus said.
No, Gussie, I wasn't sneezing, Maggie offered helpfully. Labradorite is a stone, just beautiful.
It really is, Pete agreed. Looks like something from outer space. If I were to make a sci-fi movie, I'd have the whole world made out of Labradorite.
Speaking of, Gus said. His eyes flicked toward mine, and I knew he'd found a way to divert the conversation from rocks. Have any of you seen Contact with Jodie Foster? That's a batshit fucking movie.
Everett, Pete said. Language.
Maggie chortled behind her hand. Her nails were painted a creamy off-white, speckled with light blue stars. Today, Pete's were painted dark red. I wondered if manicures were something Maggie had gotten her into, a bit of her wife that had rubbed off on her over the years. I always liked that thought, the way two people really did seem to grow into one, or at least two overlapping parts, trees with tangled roots.
Back to the event, Pete said, turning to me again. Maybe 7 would be good, so we're not cutting into too much beach time.
Sounds great, I said. Would you mind emailing me all the details to confirm? I can double-check my calendar when I get home.
I don't know about details. All you really need to know is what time to show up. Maggie and I will come up with some good questions, Pete said.
My hesitancy must have shown, because Gus leaned in a bit. I'll email you.
Gus Everett, I've seen even less proof that you have email than I've seen that you own a bathing suit, I said.
He shrugged, his eyebrows flicking upward.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one, Pete said. You can only send so many unanswered dog videos before you start wondering if the addressee is trying to tell you something with his silence.
Gus hooked an arm around Pete's neck.
I've told you I don't check my email. That doesn't mean I'm incapable of sending one when asked. In person, for a good reason.
Dog videos are a good reason for just about anything, Maggie mused.
What do we need with those with your own dogs running around? Gus asked.
Speaking of Labradors, Maggie said, what I was saying about Labradorite...
Gus looked at me, grinning. As it turned out, he was entirely right. We should have, at all costs, avoided the topic of rocks. I lost track of the conversation fairly quickly as she moved from one stone to the next, spurred by interesting tidbits of information that reminded her of other interesting tidbits. After a while, even Pete's mostly adoring gaze seemed to glaze over.
Oh, good,
she said, a bit indiscreetly, as someone else came around the side of the house.
I'd better greet the guests.
If you want to go say hi, Gus told Maggie, don't let us stop you.
Maggie made a face of exaggerated shock.
Never, she cried, taking hold of Gus's arm. Your aunt may be fickle, but to me, no one is more important than you, Gussie. Not even the Labradors. Don't tell them, of course.
I leaned into Gus and whispered,
not even the Labradorite.
His face turned an inch toward mine, and he smiled. He was so close that most of his face looked blurry to me, and the smell of the blue punch on his blue lips made my blood feel like it was spiked with pop rocks.
So I'm right after the Labradors?
A man at the table teased Maggie.
Now, don't be silly, Gilbert,
Pete said, striding back with the newcomers and a beautiful bouquet in her hands.
You're tied with the Labradors.
Gus looked down at me, and his smile faded into a crooked, thoughtful expression. I was watching him retreat into himself and felt a sudden desperation to scrabble for purchase, grab fistfuls of him to keep him there. His eyes cut to me.
I've got to get some of this blue punch out of my body. You okay here by yourself?
Sure, I said. Unless you're actually going inside to hide baby pictures of yourself, in which case, no, I am not okay here by myself.
I'm not doing that.
Are you sure? I pressed,
trying to make him smile, to bring happy, safe Gus back to the surface. Because Pete will tell me, there's no hiding them. The corner of his mouth hitched up, and his eyes sparked.
If you want to follow me into the bathroom, to be sure, that's your prerogative.
My stomach sang up through my throat. Okay.
Okay,
he said. Already, heat was flooding my body under his sharp stare. Gus, I said, would you like me to come to the bathroom with you? He laughed, didn't move. His eyes skirted down me and back up, then flashed sidelong toward Pete. When he looked back to me, his smile had fallen, the gleam in his eyes gone without a trace.
That's okay, he said. I'll be right back.
He touched my arm gently, then turned and went inside, leaving me more mortified than I'd been in a long time, or at least than I'd been since the night I drank wine out of my purse at book club. Unfortunately, I imagined I would now be going that route again, trying to blot out the memory of what had just happened. Gus had turned me down. Hours after he'd had me against a bookshelf, he'd turned me down. This was somehow so much worse than the worst-case scenario my brain had concocted when I'd weighed the pros and cons of starting something with Gus. Why did he say that thing about wanting me for so long? It had seemed so sexy in the moment, but now it made me feel like I was a loose end he'd finally gotten to tie up. My stupid, fatal flaw had struck again. I waited beside the sliding glass door, face burning and buried in my drink for a few minutes. I jumped when my phone buzzed with an email from Gus. My heart began to race, then sank miserably when I opened it. There was nothing in it except Event at Pete's Books, August 2nd, 7 p.m. I thought back to what Maggie had said about how what Gus and I did was so different externally that this would be interesting. I was fairly sure I'd just committed to doing a book event with him. Dumb bunny, dumb bunny, dumb bunny. I'd spent a month in near constant contact with Gus. If I'd spent a month solid with nothing but a blood-drenched volleyball, I imagined I too would be crying as the tide swept it out to sea. But no, that wasn't true. It wasn't just loneliness and a tendency to romanticize that had gotten me here. I knew Gus. I knew his life was messy. I knew that his walls were so thick it would take years to chisel through them, and that his mistrust of the world went nearly core deep. I knew I was not the magical one who could fix it all just by being me. When it came down to it, I knew exactly who Gus Everett was, and it didn't change a thing. Because even though he would probably never learn to dance in the rain, it was Gus I wanted. Only Gus. Exactly, Gus. I had set myself up for heartbreak, and now I suspected there was nothing I could do but brace myself and wait for it to hit. Chapter 22. The Trip.
Oh, come on, Gussie, get in!
Maggie splashed water toward the edge of the pool, but Gus merely stepped back, shaking his head and grinning.
What? Are you afraid it will mess up your perm?
Pete teased from the grill. And then we'll find out you have a perm? I added. When his eyes cut to me, a thrill went through me, followed by the disappointing realization that the saggy one-piece Maggie had lent me made me look like a waterlogged popsicle tangled in toilet paper.
Maybe I'm afraid that once I get in, no one will set a timer and remind me to get out and use the bathroom, Gus said.
At the far end of the pool, a stringy little boy and chubby little girl cannonballed in from opposite sides, their splash soaking us. Gus looked back to me.
And then there's that.
What? I said. Fun? Are you afraid it's contagious?
No, I'm afraid the pool's already totally full of pee. You two enjoy bathing in it.
Gus went back inside, and I tried not to keep checking every minute or so whether he'd emerged again. Maggie found a beach ball, and we started hitting it back and forth. Soon enough, it was 4 o'clock, and since Sonia was coming at 5, I excused myself to change. Maggie hopped spryly out too, and grabbed the yellow towels we'd left on the cement around the pool. She draped one over my shoulders before I could grab it from her and led the way inside.
You can use the upstairs bathroom,
she said with a sweet smile that seemed almost like a wink. Oh, I said uncomfortably. Okay. I gathered my clothes and went to the stairs. The steps were creaky, wooden, and narrow. They turned back on themselves halfway before depositing me into the upstairs hallway. The bathroom sat at the end, a pink tile monstrosity that was so ugly it became cute again. There were two doors on one side of the hall, and a third on the other, all of them closed. It was almost time to leave. I was going to have to knock on them until I found him. I tried not to feel embarrassed or hurt, but it wasn't easy. From your first real conversation, Gus made it clear he wasn't the type to expect anything from January, the kind not even you were capable of romanticizing. I toweled off and dressed in the bathroom, then came out and knocked softly on the first door. No answer, so I moved to the one across the hall. A mumbled, "Yeah?" came through it, and I eased it open. Gus was on the twin bed in the corner, legs stretched out and back propped up by the wall. To his right, the blinds were partly open, letting in streaks of light between the shadows on the floor.
Time to head out?
He asked, scratching the back of his head. I looked around the room at the mismatched furniture, the lack of plants. On the bedside table, there was a lamp that looked like a soccer ball, and across from the foot of the bed, the little blue bookcase there was full of copies, U.S. editions and foreign ones, of Gus's books. Come here to ponder your own mortality? I asked, tipping my head toward the bookshelf.
Just had a headache, he said.
I went toward the bed to sit beside him, but he stood before I reached it.
I'd better say bye. You should too, if you don't want Pete to blacklist you.
And then he was leaving the room, and I was left there alone. I went closer to the bookshelf. Four framed pictures sat along the top. One of a baby with dark eyes, surrounded by fluffy fake clouds and under a soft focus. The next was Pete and Maggie, a good 30 years younger, with sunglasses on top of their heads and a little boy in sandals standing between them. Over his head, between Pete's and Maggie's shoulders, a sliver of the Cinderella castle was visible. The third picture was much older, a sepia-toned portrait of a grinning little girl with dark curls and one dimple. The fourth was a team picture, little boys and girls in purple jerseys all lined up next to a younger, slimmer Pete, wearing a whistle around her neck and a cap low over her eyes. I found Gus right away, thin and messy with a bashful smile that favored one side. Voices filtered up from downstairs then.
Sure you can't stay, Pete was saying.
I set the photo down and left the room, closing the door on my way out. We were quiet for the first couple of minutes of the drive home, but Gus finally asked,
Did you have fun?
Pete and Maggie are wonderful, I answered noncommittally. Gus nodded.
They are.
Okay, I said, unsure where to go from there. His hard gaze shifted my way, softening a little, but he jammed his mouth shut and didn't look my way again. I stared at the buildings whipping past the window. The businesses had mostly closed for the day, but there'd been a parade while we were at Pete's, and vendor carts still lined either side of the street, families clad in red, white, and blue milling between them with bags of popcorn and American flag pinwheels in their hands. I had so many questions, but all of them were nebulous, unaskable. In my own story, I didn't want to be the heroine who let some silly miscommunication derail something obviously good, but in my real life, I felt like I'd rather risk that and keep my dignity than keep laying everything out for Gus until he finally came right out and admitted he didn't want me the way I wanted him. More than once, I thought miserably, something real, even if a little misshapen. When we reached the curb in front of our houses, markedly later than we would have due to the increased pedestrian traffic, Gus said,
Let me know about tomorrow.
Tomorrow? I said.
The New Eden trip.
He unlocked the car door.
If you still want to go, let me know.
This was all it had taken? He was now totally disinterested in me, even as a research companion? He climbed out of the car. That was it. 5 p.m. and we were going our separate ways. On the 4th of July, when I knew no one in town apart from him and his aunts. Why wouldn't I want to go? I asked, fuming. I said I wanted to. He was already halfway to his porch. He turned back and shrugged. Do you want me to? I demanded.
If you want, he said.
That's not what I asked you. I asked you if you want me to come with you tomorrow.
I want you to do whatever you want to do.
I folded my arms over my chest. What time? I barked.
9-ish, he said. It'll probably take all day.
Great. See you then. I went into my house and paced angrily. And when that didn't do the trick, I sat at my computer and wrote furiously until night fell. When I couldn't get out another bitter word, I went onto the deck and watched the fireworks streak over the lake, their glitter raining down on the water like falling stars. I tried not to look Gus's way, but the glow of his computer in the kitchen caught my eye every once in a while. He was still working at midnight when Shoddy texted me, "Well, that's it. I'm in love. R.I.P. me." Same. I awoke to a house-shaking boom of thunder and rolled out of bed. It was 8 o'clock, but the room was still dark from the storm clouds. Shivering, I dragged my robe off the chair at the vanity and hurried into the kitchen to put the water on. Great slashes of lightning leapt from the sky to hit the churning lake, the light fluttering against the back doors like a series of camera flashes. I watched it in a stupor. I'd never seen a storm out over a massive body of water, at least outside of a movie. I wondered if it would affect Gus's plans. Maybe it'd be better if it did, if he could effectively ghost me. I'd call and cancel the event at the bookstore, and we'd never see each other, and he could stick to his precious, once-only non-dating rule, and I could go to Ohio and marry an insurance man. Whatever that meant. Behind me, the kettle whistled. I made myself some coffee and sat down to work, and again, the words poured out of me. I had reached the 40,000-word mark. The family's world was coming apart. Eleanor's father's second family had shown up at the circus. Her mother had had a rough encounter with a guest and was more on edge than ever. Eleanor had slept with the boy from Tulsa and been caught sneaking back into her tent, only for the mechanic, Nick, to cover for her. And the clowns. They'd nearly been outed after a tender moment in the woods behind the fairgrounds, and they'd gotten into a huge argument because of it. One of them had left for the bar in town and wound up sleeping it off in a holding cell. I didn't know how things were going to come together, but I knew they needed to get worse. It was 9:15 by then, and I hadn't heard from Gus. I went and sat on the unmade bed, staring out the window toward his study. I could see warm golden light pouring from lampshades through his window. I texted him. Will this weather interfere with research?
It probably won't be a comfortable trip, he said, but I'm still going.
And I'm still invited? I asked.
Of course.
A minute later, he texted again.
Do you have hiking boots?
Absolutely not, I told him.
What size do you wear?
7.5, why? Do you think we wear the same size?
I'll grab some from Pete, he said.
Then,
if you still want to come.
Dear God, are you trying to kick me out of this? I typed back. It took him much longer to answer than usual, and the wait started making me feel sick. I used the time to get dressed. Finally, he replied,
No, I just don't want you to feel obligated.
I waffled, debating what to do. He texted me again.
Of course I want you to come, if you want to.
Not of course, I replied, simultaneously angry and relieved. You haven't made that clear at all.
Is it clear now? He asked.
Clearer.
I want you to come, he said.
Then go get the shoes.
Bring your laptop if you want, he replied. I might need to be there for a while.
20 minutes later, Gus honked from the curb, and I put on my rain jacket and ran through the storm. He leaned over to open the door before I'd even gotten there, and I slammed it shut again behind me, pulling the hood down. The car was warm, the windows were foggy, and the back seat was loaded with flashlights, an oversized backpack, a smaller waterproof one, and a pair of muddy hiking boots with red shoelaces. When he saw me looking at them, Gus said,
"They're eights, will that work?"
When I looked back at him, he almost seemed to startle, but it was such a small gesture I might have imagined it. "Lucky for you, I brought a pair of thick socks just in case." I pulled the balled-up socks from my jacket pocket and tossed them at him. He caught them and turned them over in his hands.
"What would you have done if the boots were too small?"
"Cut off my toes," I said flatly. Finally, he cracked a smile, looking up at me from under his thick, inky eyelashes. His hair was swept off his forehead, per usual, and a few raindrops had splattered across his skin when I jumped into the car. As he swallowed, the dimple in his cheek appeared, then vanished from sight. I hated what that did to me. A tiny carrot should really not overpower the instinct in my dumb bunny brain screaming, "Run!"
"Ready?"
Gus said. I nodded. He faced forward in his seat and pulled away from our houses. The rain had slowed enough that the windshield wipers could squeak across the glass at an easy pace, and we fell into a fairly comfortable rhythm, talking about our books and the rain and the blue punch. We moved off that last topic fairly quickly, neither of us apparently willing to broach yesterday. "Where are we going?" I asked, an hour in, when he pulled off the highway. From my online search, I knew New Eden was at least another hour off.
"Not a murder spot," he promised.
"Is it a surprise?"
"If you want it to be, but it might be a disappointing one."
"The world's largest ball of yarn?" I guessed. His gaze cut toward me, narrowed in appraisal.
"That would disappoint you?"
"No," I said, heart leaping traitorously. "But I thought you might think it would."
"There are certain wonders that no man can face without weeping, January. A giant ball of yarn is one of those."
"Okay, you can tell me," I said.
"We're getting gas."
I looked at him. "Okay, that is disappointing."
"Much like life."
"Not this again," I said. It was another 63 minutes before Gus pulled off the highway again near Arcadia, and then another 15 miles on wooded two-lane roads before he pulled over onto a muddy shoulder and told me to stuff my computer in the dry bag. "Now, this is definitely a murder spot," I said when we got out. As far as I could tell, there was nothing here but the steep bank to our right and the trees above it.
"It's probably someone's," Gus said.
He leaned back into the car.
"But not mine. Now change your shoes. We have to walk the rest of the way."
Gus pulled on the bigger backpack and took one of the flashlights, leaving me to grab the other bag once I'd gotten the socks and shoes on.
"This way,"
he called, climbing straight up the muddy ridge to the woods. He turned to offer me a hand, and after I slipped in the mud thrice, he managed to hoist me up onto the path. At least it appeared to be a path, although there were no signs or visible reasons for a path to start there. The forest was quiet, apart from our tromping and our breaths and the underlying drizzling of rain speckling the leaves. I kept my hood up, but in here, the rain mostly made it to us in the form of fine mist. I'd gotten used to the blues and grays of the lake, the yellow golds of the sun spilling over the water and the tops of the trees, but in here, everything was rich and dark, every shade of green the most saturated version of itself. This was the most at peace I had felt in 2 days, if not all year. Whatever weirdness was between Gus and me was placed on hold as we wandered through the silent temple of the woods. Sweat built up around my armpits, along my hairline, and through my underwear until I stopped and took the jacket off. Without a word, Gus stopped and peeled his off too. I watched an olive sliver of his flat stomach appear as his shirt caught around his shoulders. I looked away as he pulled it back down. We picked our backpacks up and kept walking. My thighs began to burn, and the gathering sweat and rain plastered my tank top and my jeans to my skin. At one point, the rain picked up again, and we ducked into a shallow pseudo-cave for a few minutes until the showers let up. The gray sky made it hard to tell how much time had passed, but we must have spent at least a couple of hours marching through the woods until the trees finally thinned and the charred skeleton of New Eden came into sight ahead.
"Holy shit," I whispered, stopping beside Gus.
He nodded.
"Have you seen it before?"
"Only in pictures,"
he said, and started toward the nearest smoke-blackened trailer. The second fire, unlike the one from the lightning strike, hadn't been an accident. The police investigation had found that every building had been doused in gasoline. The prophet, a man who called himself Father Abe, had died outside the last building to catch flames, leading authorities to speculate that he'd been the one to light the place up. Gus swallowed. His voice came out hoarse as he pointed toward a trailer on the right.
"That was the nursery. They went first."
Went, I thought. Burned, I thought. I turned to hide that I was gagging.
"People are awful,"
Gus said behind me. I swallowed my stomach bile. My eyes stung. The back of my nose burned. Gus glanced over his shoulder at me, and his gaze softened.
"Want to set up the tent?"
He must have seen the face I made, because he added quickly,
"So we can use our computers."
He nodded toward the darkly churning sky as he slid his backpack off.
"Don't think this is going to let up anytime soon."
"Not here, though," I said. "It feels wrong to put a tent in all this."
He nodded agreement, and we kept moving, hiked off until the site was no longer visible, until I could almost pretend we were in a different forest, far away from what had happened at New Eden. As Gus pulled tent poles from the bag, I came forward to help. My hands were shaking, both from the cold and the unease of being here, and I poured all of my focus into piecing the tent together, blocking out the memory of the burned remnants of the cult. The distraction only lasted a few minutes, and then the tent was finished, all our stuff tucked safely inside, except the little notepad and pencil Gus pulled from his pocket as we made our way back to the site. He shot me a tentative look I couldn't interpret, then started toward one of the trailers, or rather three that had been cobbled together with plywood and tarp hallways. I swallowed a knot and followed, but after a few steps, he stopped and turned back to me.
"You can go back to the tent," he said gruffly. "You don't need to see this."
A knot rose in my throat. Obviously, I didn't want to see this, but it bothered me that he'd say I didn't need to while still planning to explore it himself. I could tell he hated being here too, and yet here he was, facing it. That was how it always was. He never looked away from any of it. Maybe he thought someone had to bear witness to the dark, or maybe he hoped that if he stared into the pitch black long enough, his eyes would adjust and he'd see answers hiding in it. "This is why bad things happen," the dark would say. "This is how it all makes sense." I couldn't go hide from this. I couldn't leave Gus here alone. If he was descending into the darkness, I was going to tie a rope between our waists and go down with him. I shook my head and went to stand behind him, his dark eyes dipping to study me, his rain-speckled lashes curved low and dark and heavy against his olive cheeks. There was so much I wanted to say, but all I could get out was, "I'm here." And when I said it, his brow furrowed and his jaw tensed, and he peered at me in that particular Gus way that made the knot in my throat inch higher. He nodded and turned back to the trailer, tipping his chin toward it.
"Father Abe's place. Apparently he'd seek counsel from a group of angels, so he needed the room."
I tore my gaze from Gus to the sooty trailer. It instantly made me feel woozy and unmoored, like the air here was still overloaded with carbon dioxide and ash. Why do bad things happen? I thought. How will it all make sense? But no great truth appeared to me. There was no good reason this horrible thing had happened, and no reason Gus's life had been what it was either. Damn it, REM was right. Every single person on the planet had to take turns hurting. Sometimes all you could do was hold on to each other tight until the dark spat you back out. Gus blinked clear of his solemn haze and crouched, balancing his notepad on his knee and scribbling notes, and I stood beside him, legs wobbling, but eyes open. I'm here, I thought at him. I'm here, and I see it too. We moved around the site like that, silent as ghosts, Gus guarding his notes from the rain as it soaked through our clothes and skin right down to the bone. When we'd circled the whole plot of land once, he headed back toward Father Abe's Frankensteined trailer, glancing at me for the first time in the last 2 hours.
It's freezing, he said. You should go back to the tent.
It was freezing. The wind had picked up and the temperature had begun dropping until my jeans felt like ice packs against my skin. But no part of me thought that was why he was pushing me away.
Please, January,
Gus said quietly. And it was the please that unraveled me. What was I doing? I cared about Gus, but if he didn't want me to hold on to him, I had to let go.
Okay, I said through chattering teeth. I'll wait in the tent.
Gus nodded, then turned and trudged off. Heart stung, I walked back to the tent, knelt, and crawled inside. I curled into the fetal position to warm myself up and closed my eyes, listening to the barrage of rain on the fabric overhead. I tried to let all my thoughts and feelings slip away from me, but instead they seemed to swell as I drifted toward sleep, a dark, frothy wave of emotions pulling me toward a restless dream. And then the whine of the zipper was tugging me out of it, and I opened my unfocused eyes to find Gus stooped in the tent's doorway, dripping.
Hey,
my voice came out gravelly. I sat up, smoothing my wet hair.
Sorry that took so long,
he said, climbing in and zipping the door up behind him.
I needed to get thorough pictures, draw a map, all that.
He sat beside me and unzipped his rain jacket, which he'd put back on since we parted ways. I shrugged.
It's fine. You said it would be an all-day thing.
His gaze lifted to the tent ceiling.
And I meant that, he said. All day. The tent was just a precaution for the weather. Too many years in Michigan.
I nodded, as if I understood. I thought I might.
Anyway,
he looked back toward my feet.
If you're ready, we can hike back.
We sat in silence for a moment. Gus, I said, tired.
Yeah?
Will you just tell me what's going on?
He folded his legs in and leaned back on his palms, staring steadily at me. He took a deep breath.
Which part?
All of it, I said. I want to know all of it.
He shook his head.
I told you, you can ask me anything.
Okay.
I swallowed a fist-sized knot. What was the deal with that phone call?
The deal?
Don't make me say it,
I whispered miserably. But he still seemed confused. I gritted my teeth and closed my eyes.
Was it Naomi?
No,
he said. But it wasn't, no, how could you think that? It sounded more like, no, but she still calls me, or no, but it was someone else I love. My stomach cinched tight, but I forced myself to open my eyes. Gus's brow had wrinkled, and a raindrop slid down his sharp cheekbone.
It was my friend Kayla Markham.
Kayla?
My voice sounded so shaky, pathetic. Gus's best friend since high school, Markham, was a woman? Sudden understanding crossed Gus's face.
It's not like, she's my lawyer. She's friends with Naomi, too. She's handling our divorce.
Oh.
It sounded small and stupid, exactly how I felt.
Your mutual friend is handling your divorce?
I know it's weird.
He mussed his hair.
I mean, it's like she's totally impartial. She throws me this big-ass birthday party every year, but then I have to see pictures of her and Naomi in Cancun for a week. We never talk about it, and yet she's handling the divorce, and it's just...
So weird, I guessed. He let out his breath in a rush.
So weird.
A little bit of the pressure in my chest released, but regardless of who Kayla Markham was to Gus, it didn't change how he'd acted yesterday.
If it's not about her,
Then why are you trying to get rid of me? I asked, voice trembling and quiet. Gus's eyes darkened.
January.
He shook his head.
I'm not doing that.
You are, I said. I'd been telling myself not to cry, but it was no use. As soon as I said it, the tears were welling, voice wrenching upward. You ignored me yesterday. You tried to cancel today. You sent me back to the tent when I tried to stay with you, and you didn't want me to come. I should have listened.
January, no.
Gus roughly cupped the sides of my face, holding my tear-filled gaze to his.
Not at all.
He kissed my forehead.
It wasn't about you, not even a little bit.
He kissed my tear-streaked left cheek, caught another falling tear with his mouth on my right. He pulled me in against his chest and wrapped his arms around me, covering me with rain-dampened heat as he nuzzled his nose and mouth against the top of my head.
I feel so stupid, I whimpered. I thought you really—
I do, he said quickly, drawing back from me. January, I didn't want you here today because I knew it was going to be hard. I didn't want to be the reason you spent a whole day in a torched-out graveyard. I didn't want to put you through this. That's all.
He brushed some hair behind my ear, and the sweetness of the gesture only made my tears fall faster.
But you didn't want me at Pete's either, I said, voice breaking. You invited me, and then we slept together, and you changed your mind.
His mouth juddered into a look of open hurt.
I wanted you there,
he all but whispered, and when a fresh tear slipped down my cheek, he caught it with his thumb.
Look, he said, this divorce has been so stupidly drawn out. I waited for her to file, and she just didn't, and I don't know, it didn't matter to me, so I didn't pursue it until a few weeks ago. She told me she'd sign the papers if I met her for a drink, so I went to Chicago to see her, and when I left, I thought it was settled. Yesterday, Markham called and told me Naomi changed her mind. She wants some details hammered out. I mean, the only things we owned together were some overpriced copper pots, which she has, and our cars. It shouldn't be complicated, but I put it off too long, and—
He rubbed at his forehead.
And then Markham asked what was new with me, and I told her about you, about how you were here for the summer, and she thought it was a bad idea.
Bad idea? My gut roiled. That didn't sound impartial. It sounded very partial.
Because you're leaving, Gus said in a rush. And she knows how stupid I am when it comes to you, how crazy I was for you in college, and—
What are you talking about? I challenged. You never even spoke to me. He let out a humorless laugh.
Because you hated me, he blurted. I'd come late to class so I could choose my seat based on where you sat, and I'd rush out afterward so I could walk with you, ask to borrow pens every day for a week, fucking drop books Three Stooges style when you hung back so it would just be the two of us, and you'd never even look at me. Even when we were workshop